Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's really a pleasure to be joined in studio today by Jamie Gordon. Her novel, Lord of Misrule, recently came out in paperback. Welcome back to Yellow Springs.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Jamie, this book is about horse racing, and I started reading it, and I said, I don't know anything about horse racing, and obviously you do, because you could have never written this book without having some knowledge of it. And I went back and I looked up some information on you after I finished the book, and lo and behold, you used to work at a racetrack.
I did. It wasn't a co-op job when I went to Antioch, though. But it wasn't long after my Antioch years. I first lived in California for a couple of years, and when I moved back to Maryland, where I was born and raised, I wanted to live in the Appalachian foothills near Frederick, Maryland, Hagerstown, Charlestown, West Virginia, Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, Winchester, Virginia, that area. I moved there. I found an appropriate job for somebody with my educational background. I was the society recreation, education, and food editor for the Frederick News Post. That will give you some idea of the kind of rag that we are talking about. And I loved that job. I actually loved being the food editor of this small town paper, writing a profile of somebody for the lead story for every Thursday edition, and sticking a few recipes on the end of it. But I ran into a racetracker in the middle of having this job that amused me and interested me no end, and found myself walking hot horses for him the next day in Charlestown. There were actually two cheap racetracks there at that time, Charlestown and Shenandoah Downs. And I was still writing for the newspapers for a while, but then we began shipping horses out of town the way the couple, the raffish young couple in my novel do, and I had to give up the food writing job. It's an autobiographical novel in at least some particulars, and that particular story is there in the novel, Lord of Misrule.
So you're Maggie?
Well, let's say that Maggie borrows from me some circumstances of her life, certainly.
She's such an innocent.
Do you think so?
I think so. And her boyfriend, Tommy, not quite so innocent.
Well, I may sound even slightly insulted that you would say that I was innocent even in a fictional version, because I was always trying so hard to not be innocent. That was my main purpose in life from my teenage years until at least the beginning of graduate school.
This book was a long time in coming. Didn't you start writing it and kind of put it aside?
I think I always knew I would write about the racetrack, but I just wasn't ready. I went to graduate school at Brown in creative writing and stayed long enough to get a doctorate. I wrote two books when I was there, and I tried to work with racetrack material, but I was really allergic to writing anything that was in any way obviously autobiographical until I was over 35. Suddenly, something changed. I began to be able to see this reckless young woman that I had been from my teenage years into my mid-20s as a character, a potential character in a work of fiction. I think that was exactly because I wasn't that person anymore, and began to see her as a character type in a certain sense. But
you left Providence. That was key, wasn't it?
That's interesting that you would know that. How do you know that? I couldn't write realistic fiction with self-confidence in Providence because my connection there was to Burning Deck Press and Keith and Rosemary Waldrop, still very close friends of mine. And I must say, Catholic readers in in terms of their own library and their historical tastes in fiction and so forth. But they were so closely associated with innovative and experimental poetry and fiction that to write a novel that could have any sort of a commercial presence at all just seemed inappropriate to my life there. And it's true, I never finished anything of that nature. I never even seriously began anything like that until I was until I had left New England altogether in 1980.
And your publisher for the original Lord of Misrule in hardcover was a friend of yours from Brown, and he only printed 2,000 copies, didn't he?
Of Lord of Misrule? That was his plan. He was going to. Yeah. He was actually going to go all out and print 2,000 copies and hope to sell them. When the book became a finalist for the National Book Award, which curiously enough was part of his plan all along. That doesn't accord, I know, with the ambition of printing only 2,000 copies. But somehow he was always saying, you must get this book done by August such and such so that we can get galley proofs to the readers for the National Book Award, because you're going to be a contender for the National Book Award this year. And after I picked myself up from the ground where I was hysterically laughing, I complied with his wishes, because he had never, in our 40-year friendship, been so insistent about anything. He's a very good friend, and we've had our tiffs and our periods of distance, but most of the time we've been very close friends, exactly because he knows how to get along with a difficult and somewhat adventurous sort of woman like me. But this time there was no fooling around. I had to work every single day to get this novel revised to my standards in a 3-month period after he got me to go back to work on it by sending me galley proofs of a very corrupt manuscript that I had sent him some years earlier. And we made the deadline by pulling all-nighters like college freshmen. And I still felt that, I feel even now that the book could have used another 2 or 3 months to get everything right, but...
But you made it. You made it at the wire, to use a racing term.
That's right.
The book is Lord of Misrule. Jamie Gordon wrote it. She joins us on the program today. Let's talk about the book. What's the basic plot? Let's talk about some of these characters. We mentioned Maggie and Tommy.
These two young people, he is a horse trainer, but he's had a college education. He's not a typical horse trainer in that sense, although he really understands horses. And Maggie is green on the racetrack. As in the real-life story that I described, Tommy meets Maggie in Harper's Ferry, near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, along a dark road near a youth hostel one night, and quickly recruits her to work on the racetrack. She gives up her beloved food copywriting job and joins this racetrack adventure. They ship horses, horses who are better than they look in their past performance charts, to an even cheaper racetrack than the one they've been racing on. And Tommy is in this venture to make a killing, but he is, in a certain sense, grandiose, more grandiose than naive in his ambitions. And they're quickly spotted by other people on this highly corrupt racetrack. At the same time, there's the other two point of view characters in the novel are an old black groom. He's 72, 73 years old, who's been on the racetrack since he was 8. And he's looking for a way off the racetrack. He's trying to make a killing so that he can retire. And
this is Medicine Ed.
Medicine Ed.
Okay.
And a loan shark named Tutai, who turns out to be Maggie's great uncle. She has known that she's got a fringe character in the family who has a racetrack background of some kind, who's a little fishy in some way. She has no idea. And really, throughout the novel, even to the end of the novel, she doesn't understand how much of a role Tutai plays in her destiny on this racetrack.
I like Tutai.
I like him, too.
He speaks a lot of Yiddish.
Well, his language is certainly peppered with Yiddish, as most of the immigrant population of his age would have spoken.
Of course, my favorite character is Joe Dale. No, I'm just kidding. Joe Dale's the villain.
There is a villain, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Although I try to make him plausibly attractive to Maggie, even though he's disgusting at the same time. He's one of the people, he's the leading trainer on this racetrack, and for some reason wants Maggie, as well as all the useful horses on this track. He just needs to control things and also to take away from anybody else anything that seems to be making them happy. So
claiming races. This is the basic concept here, which I didn't know anything about, and I kind of understand a little bit after reading your book. Explain the concept of the claiming race.
I'm going to try to say this as simply as possible because it has always amazed me that even though most Americans, I suppose, have had some experience of the racetrack, they were taken to the track maybe once or twice in their lives, they have no idea that the most common kind of race is a race where all the horses are for sale to anybody else who is an owner or trainer in the same race meeting, in the same racing season at that particular track. Theoretically, this keeps the race honest because it means that all the horses have to be worth hypothetically are worth the $5,000 or $10,000 or $6,000 price of that particular race because they can be bought by anybody else who's running a horse during that season at that track for that price. But, of course, the whole game is to try to run a horse that's worth more money for a lower price because that will increase his or her chances of winning the race. The great anxiety of this game is that somebody will spot you trying to do this and claim your horse. So you do everything you can to keep it a secret. And by the way, this isn't only on cheap racetracks. Claiming races are the main part of the ticket at the racing card at expensive tracks as well. Mm. Claiming races at very expensive tracks might go up to $35,000. Claiming races can be worth more than the most expensive race that was not even a claiming race at any track that I ever worked on. Mm. But I only know cheap racing. I really even though I was born and raised within 2 miles of Pimlico Racetrack and ended up having some contacts there that were very helpful to me when I was working on this book, that was not what my personal experience of horse racing as a racetracker myself was.
My guest is Jamie Gordon. Her book is Lord of Misrule. Perhaps we could read a little excerpt. Would you be up for reading a little bit of that for our listeners?
Certainly. I'm going to read just a very short passage, which is from the point of view of Maggie. We'll give you some idea of why Maggie is such a sucker for this racetrack life. She is entranced, really, by the beauty, the tragic beauty of horses, especially once classy racehorses who are on their way down, who are just gutting it out on courage alone. And she is in particular taken with a horse named Pelter. And she's also found a way to massage horses that really seems to be having a good effect. She rubbed in a round, hypnotic finger-painting motion, but hard, feeling for some remotely erotic synapse of Z's from the ends of her fingers into his bones and muscles, which wasn't as easy through the pink gunny as it had always been barehanded with Pelter. She had to slow down time, go into a kind of trance state where sweet electricity pulled at her nerve endings like nectar on the pistil of a honeysuckle. And then by running her fingers over the animal, she could find his hidden landing places. Not that these were jungle airstrips, few and hard to find. They were all over the place. But you had to approach the body boundary reduced to this one brooding spark. You dangled from a headland, black, empty space rushing by, and suddenly you were across. The key was being tuned down so fine that you felt the crossing. Without that, your fingers were just dead prongs on a rake, and nothing happened. I should say that if there's anything that people have commented on widely about this book, it's that the inner voices of the four different points of view are so different from one another, I hope. I mean, that was what I planned. So that's Maggie's inner voice, but we also have Two Ties and Medicine Ed's and maybe the spookiest and strangest, Tommy Hansel's.
I still think she's an innocent. My guest is Jamie Gordon. The book is Lord of Misrule. Recently came out in paperback. And last year, we had Nicole Krauss on the program with her most recent book, which was one of the five finalists, along with your book, for the National Book Award in 2010. And when they had the awards ceremony, I'm guessing that Nicole was probably wearing a brand new dress and that she had her speech all ready. And then they called your name.
Yes.
And you were very surprised, weren't you?
I deny that I screamed, though. That story has been falsely reported as far away as Los Angeles. That was my sister who was there. Both my sisters were there, but one of them in particular screamed. No, we weren't expecting for me to win. I thought my entire life and fortunes had been changed sufficiently just by being a finalist. My new editor at Vintage was there, Tim O'Connell. My new agent, Bill Clegg, who I wanted for my agent for years and years. I had everything that I wanted. And the other four writers had written such weighty books, such topically important novels. I just thought there was no way in the world on that basis alone. I mean, not that content is what designates the winner of even the National Book Awards, but there was such a difference in approach, shall we say, between a novel about the dinkiest, most corrupt and shabby racetrack in West Virginia in 1970, the era of the Vietnam War, which isn't even mentioned once in the book. And Peter Carey's Parrot and Olivier in America, a novel which in a way is referencing de Tocqueville's early view of the American democracy. Lionel Shriver's novel about the American healthcare system. Karen Tay Yamashita's wonderful I Hotel about Asian immigration into the Bay Area over a 100-year period, and Nicole Krauss's wonderful Great House, which is all about a desk that migrates between areas of political strife around the world from World War II Europe to the South America, the Desaparecidos, and so on. I mean, these books all made such ambitious claims on the public attention in a way that mine didn't. So, yes, I was having a good time. I was even eating the chicken. I was hardly paying attention. And I almost missed it when they announced my name because they, because before then they had always said the author's name first when they announced a winner, And I heard an L coming, and I was sure it was going to be Lionel Shriver, and it took me a minute to realize that they had said the title of my book. So I was unprepared. One is warned to, just in case, have an acceptance speech ready, and I shamelessly didn't do that. And I really am sorry now, because at the very least, I should have thanked the judges for their courage. The novel had not even been out yet. It hadn't been reviewed anywhere. Its pub date was November 15th, and the National Book Awards were November 17th. I might have those dates reversed. I forget. But nobody had seen it, and they could have really made fools of themselves. Judges have been taken to task in the past, they chose the book that they wanted, and I should at least have thanked them for it publicly.
Well, I think that Andrei Codrescu was one of the judges, and he probably was really pushing hard for your book.
Why do you think that?
That's just my theory.
I think you're right.
That's my theory.
I
don't know Andrei,
right,
but I'm taking a guess.
Well, he does love the book.
I'll bet he does.
Yeah.
The book is Lord of Misrule. Jamie Gordon wrote it, and it was originally published in hardcover, a very limited print run by your friend, your long-time buddy from Brown, and
Bruce McPherson.
So McPherson and Company was the publisher.
Yes.
And now the paperback has been issued by a big publisher. Have you seen it in an airport yet?
Oh, yes, I saw it in many airports. I mean, I had occasion to travel a lot last year. And don't think that I didn't check out every airport bookshop I could. When it stopped being so easy to find in airport bookshops, of course, I didn't want to go in them anymore. But at first, it was everywhere, even in hardcover, which was amazing. Bruce ended up selling 45,000 copies of the novel in hardcover, which is incredible. But in some sense, he ended up doing a canny thing. Whether on purpose or not, I'm not sure. That is, having the book just come into print within 2 days of the National Book Awards meant that at least for the first 3 months of its life as a National Book Award winner, it was only available in hardcover. And so even though he had spent his entire life as a publisher making sure that he would never make a red dime on any book, he ended up doing really quite well with his book. So then all of his former authors wanted to claim their royalties, none of which he had ever paid in the past. I think he's had to learn publishing in a different way than he ever knew it before. But he's a great person and really an interesting press.
Well, I know you've written other books, and after all these years and all this work, I hate to use this term, but how did you finally write a book that was, quote, accessible?
I want to say that, by the way, that my second novel, the one that came out from Algonquin around 1990, She Drove Without Stopping, is also a pretty accessible novel.
I have not read it. I'm sorry.
Well, that's the one that if anybody wants to see a kind of a caricature of Yellow Springs and Antioch College in the mid-60s, they should take a look at that book. I'm sure they won't be able to miss it, even though it's called Harmonia College and in Harmonia Springs. But how did I finally write well, I had this racetrack material for years and years. And when I first finished a draft of the novel, about 10 years before it actually came out, maybe 7 years, I gave it to my then agent, a quite decent agent who has a pretty strong presence in New York. And I said, I think I've written my most commercial book ever, and if you're ever going to sell one, this should be it. And she didn't really like the novel that well. She read it, and it is, after all, a sports book, and it's a view. I love it that you think Maggie's an innocent, but she's not a... a reliable, good citizen of a young woman. She's a a raffish adventuress of a woman.
Well, that's why I liked her so much.
Well, I like that too. I find, yeah. In fact, I think that maybe that persona that I wrote about for years, finding to my dismay and surprise, wasn't so interesting to people. Suddenly, came into its own one way or another. But my agent then, I think she was kind of turned off by this this reckless young woman, and showed the book without enthusiasm to agents who liked a more typical kind of women's fiction of that period. And after she had a few rejections, she came back to me and said, "Jamie, I think you've written another small press book. I'm sorry to tell you."
Ouch.
And it was very painful. I was very mad. We parted company over that.
Oh, no.
But at the same time, my confidence was shaken. And I did feel the book needed a rewrite, but not because it was inaccessible mm-hmm. or small press book. I mean, I really felt that I'd written a novel with an exciting plot and if I hadn't been distracted, I think I would have gone on to find a better agent for it and to try to sell it right then. Mm. But my 50s, I'm in my 60s now, my 50s were, like so many people's, involved with the deaths of my two parents and other things that happened in my family. So I didn't really pay very much attention to the book. And then I developed a positive aversion to reading it again. I was mad at that reckless young woman who hadn't panned out for me. I just didn't even want to look at her. I thought she had sneaked into this book on false premises because I meant to write a social novel about cheap racetracks. Mm. And she was the outsider, really, in that.
Well, I'm
situation. Looking
at the clock, Jamie, and I can't believe it. We've already used up our time for the program, and I would love to keep talking to you because we haven't even talked about your years in Yellow Springs, and I'd love to hear an excerpt from this book that is obviously related autobiographically in some way to Yellow Springs and Antioch College. It's a novel, but as you alluded to a moment ago, it apparently is very much inspired by your time here. You graduated from Antioch College in 1966, is that right?
That's right, but I actually was not living in town again after 1965,
okay.
So...
Well, if you could stick around for another segment, we'd love to keep talking to you about it.
I'd be pleased.
All right. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Tune in next week for another segment with Jamie Gordon, right here on WYSO. In our next segment, we'll be talking to Jamie about her memories of going to Antioch College in the mid-60s, what it was like in Yellow Springs, Ohio back then, and maybe she'll even tell us about some of her favorite teachers in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.